Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 3. Liberation from the illusory energy. Text number 41. Hopefully stand us all in good stead. Liberation from the illusory energy. Anybody like a bit of that? Srirajovacha
Srirajovacha
Kama Yogam Vadattana
Kama Yogam Vadattana
Purusho Jina Samskrita
Purusho Jina Samskrita
Vidhu Yehashu Karmani
Vidhu Yehashu Karmani
Param
Naishkaryam Vindate Param
Sri Raja Uvacha
Sri Raja Uvacha.
The king said,
the king said,
which king?
Nimi.
Maharaj Nimi. Who was the king who precipitated this conversation? Vasudev. Good. Okay, excellent. Karma Yogam, the practice of dovetailing,
one's work
with the Supreme. Vadata, please tell. Naha, us. Purushaha, a person. Jena,
by which.
Samskritaha,
Samskritaha,
being refined. Vidhuya, getting rid of.
Iha,
in this life. Ashu,
quickly.
Karamani,
Karamani,
materialistic activities.
Naishkarmyam,
freedom from fruitive reactions.
Freedom from fruitive reactions.
Vindate.
Vindate.
Enjoys.
Enjoys.
Param.
Param.
Transcendental.
Transcendental.
King Nimi said, O great sages, please speak to us about the process of karma yoga. Purified by this process of dedicating one's practical work to the Supreme, a person can very quickly free himself from all material activities, even in this life, and thus enjoy pure life on a transcendental platform. Translation responsibly. King Nimi said, O great sages,
please speak to us
about the process of karma yoga. Purified by this process of dedicating one's practical work to the Supreme, a person can very quickly free himself from all material activities,
even in this life,
and thus enjoy
pure life
on the transcendental platform.
On the transcendental platform.
Purport, as stated in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 5, Nahi kaschit chanamapi jatu tishtatya karma krit karyate hiyavasha karma saravaha prakriti jaya gunahai. All men are forced to act helplessly according to the impulses born of the modes of material nature. Therefore, no one can refrain from doing something, not even for a moment. Since the living entity cannot remain inactive, he must learn to dedicate his activities to the Lord. Srila Prabhupada comments on this verse from Bhagavad Gita as follows. It is not a question of embodied life, but it is the nature of the soul to be always active. Without the presence of the spirit soul, The material body cannot move. The body is only a dead vehicle to be worked by the spirit soul, which is always active and cannot stop even for a moment. As such, the spirit soul has to be engaged in the good work of Krishna consciousness, otherwise it will be engaged in occupations dictated by illusory energy. In contact with material energy, the spirit soul acquires material modes, and to purify the soul from such affinities, it is necessary to engage in the prescribed duties enjoined in the Shastras. But if the soul is engaged in his natural function of Krishna consciousness, whatever he is able to do is good for him. Ordinary people often question the busy activities of the devotees of the Krishna consciousness movement, mistaking such activities to be ordinary material work. Srila Jiva Goswami has stated in this connection, Kamya karmanya eva cha jitani natu nitya naimittikani phalasya eva vinindititvat. One should give up selfish activities performed for one's personal sense gratification. Kamya karma neva chajitani. Chaj means like chagi, I suppose. It means to give up, right? Give up kamya karma. Means activities that are motivated by one's personal desires. I'm assuming that this sentence after this Sanskrit is going to be the translation of it. One should give up selfish activities performed for one's personal sense gratification, since the result of such thoughtless work is further material bondage. Nitya naimittikani. But one should offer one's regular or occasional occupational duties to the Supreme Lord, and thus such activities become transcendental devotional service. By the words Tasmat Gurum Prapadyeta Jigyasu Sraya Uttamam, this chapter has clearly explained that dovetailing one's work with the service of the Lord is an art one should learn at the lotus feet of a bona fide spiritual master. Otherwise, if one whimsically declares his materialistic work to be transcendental devotional service, there will be no actual result. In fact, you'll get the opposite. You'll get a result, but it won't be devotional service, it'll be karma. Kamya karma. Therefore, according to Sri Jiva Goswami, one should not mistake the word naishkamyam to indicate inactivity. Rather, it indicates transcendental activity under the guidance of the Lord and his representative. Om Arjanatimirandasya Kimpujana Sanakaya Chakshurun Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Vishnam Stav Tam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapadantikam Mukam Karoti Vatalam Pankum Lankaya Degrim Yakripa Kamaham Bande Sri Guru Dinatayanam. So, another question by Maharaj Nimi. And that question is basically, what is karma? What is karma? And how to get free from it? Certainly that's free from reactions of karma. Both good and bad. Maharaj is quoting this verse from Bhagavad Gita and Prabhupada's commentary, that to free ourselves from karma doesn't mean stopping doing things. There's a misconception. This idea that one can stop karma by sitting still and doing nothing is erroneous. Because as Krishna points out in the Bhagavad Gita, you may try to sit still and do nothing, but that's impossible. The only way you can do something like that is if you're dead, basically. Effectively. Because even if we're, you know, even if we're lying down, sleeping, still we're dreaming. You know. Or at least the heart is beating and the blood is pumping and, you know, there's things going on, obviously. When you're in a deep state of unconscious sleep, then mental activities may not be functioning, but still the body is working because of the presence of the soul. Only when the soul is not present, then we get inactivity. And that's called death. But of course, the soul has then travelled on to another location and is performing activities there. So it's not that one has to give up action. But rather the point is, one has to perform the right action. The correct activities have to be performed. So that propensity to act is properly engaged in activities, positive actions that will produce purified consciousness and then liberation, basically, or disconnect, if you like, from materially motivated activities. And then the activities in that state of purification are motivated by a desire for purification, at least, minimally. This is why in the Bhagavad Gita, the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recommends action based on transcendental knowledge. And that action based on transcendental knowledge is basically elucidated in the third chapter, sacrifice. Jagyata kamanonyatra loko yam kama bandhana. You know, if you want to be free from the reactions of your activities, then you have to perform a particular type of work. Otherwise, if you don't work in that way, then you'll be bound by your actions. And the type of activity that's recommended, jagya. Right? Sacrifice. In other words, activities that are connected to the Supreme, to Lord Vishnu. Jagyarta kamano nyatra loko yam karma bandana. And in the fourth chapter, Krishna explains how you do that. 434. Tadvidhi panipatena pariprasnena sevaya. One has to learn the art of jagya, learn the art of sacrifice. Learn the art of turning what is ostensibly material activities into spiritual activities. I mean, a classic example of that is eating, right? You have to eat. In order to live, practically speaking, you have to eat. Anybody here who can live without eating? Probably a few people would like to be able to live without eating, so they can lose a bit of weight. But usually that's a problem, that's a worry. But even with the desire to not eat, we still eat. Because you can't survive without eating. Uh, And, you know, basically eating is to satisfy the tongue. Jiva vegam, the pushing of the tongue. Udrapasta vegam, to fill the belly also. So we need to satisfy those urges. So we can do that in Krishna consciousness very easily. We take our foodstuffs, and then the sacrifice is, rather than prepare it for ourselves, for our pleasure, we prepare it for Krishna's pleasure. It's actually a very, it's a mystical process. When you think about it, we prepare the same type of food as anybody else, ostensibly. But then the focus or the purpose is different. The food is prepared with an eye for pleasing Krishna. That's a sacrifice. You know, I was talking to my cousin on Sunday. She's a doctor, but she got so exhausted with her work as a doctor, she couldn't work anymore as a doctor. You can probably relate to this. now she's doing a course in food technology. And I was telling her how, you know, in Krishna consciousness, many of the practices, just the basic practices of preparing food, are the same practices as have been recommended by the food technologists. You know, keep very clean, don't touch your face, don't taste things while you're cooking. You know, just basic things. And you know, the consciousness of the person that's cooking the food, very important. So for the devotees, the whole process of doing something that everybody does, basically. Cooking is done with the mentality of wanting to please Krishna. And then the food that's offered to Krishna then becomes sanctified, purified, prasad.
Chakyasishtasanasanto mucchante sava kilvishai. Bunjate te tukam papam ye pachantya makaranat. Krishna mentions that those who are accustomed to taking the remnants of jagya, sacrifice, and this is a sacrifice, preparing the food and offering it to Krishna first, is a sacrifice. Those who bunjate te tukam papam, those who eat the remnants of sacrifice, get purified. And their sinful reactions are dissolved, are cleansed, are removed. So it's an example. Something that everybody's doing is eating. The same activity performed by the devotees purifies them, purifies the consciousness, clears away sinful reactions. Whereas for those who don't perform that activity in the mode of sacrifice to Vishnu, they become contaminated and accumulate more reactions by that activity. So it's a good example. Same activity, same process, practically speaking, but when that activity is performed under the guidance of the spiritual master, ultimately for the pleasure of Krishna, then that same activity, even the eating of the food, or at least for us, the honouring of the prasadam, it fulfills the need to eat and the need to sustain ourselves. This is the anamaya consciousness. You know, I eat, therefore I am. And if I don't eat, then I'll die. You notice that in India more than you do in Australia, at least I do anyway. You get in India, for some reason or other, the modes work differently there, and when you get really hungry, then you're starving. And you feel like if you don't have something to eat, then you're going to die. You ever experienced that? As a kid? No. you're a transcendentalist. I feel that in India, you know, if you don't have your breakfast, or if you don't have lunch, or if you don't have any dinner, if you don't have something to eat at night, in the morning it's almost impossible to chant your rounds because you don't have any energy and your mind's agitated. So, we like to eat. We have the need to eat to sustain ourselves. And when it's performed in this mood of sacrifice, then the whole process becomes purified. Whereas if it is performed without that consideration of sacrifice, then the whole process becomes basically entangling. So that science of yajna, or turning our activities into service, iha dasya hare dasya karmana manasagira, our activities, our thinking, our speaking, all of these things, when they're dovetailed in Krishna's service, then they actually become the source of our purification. Nikala Svapyavastasu Jiva Mukta Sa Uchite. He said, a person who can engage all of their activities, kamana, manasa, thoughts, gira, speech, in devotional service, then that person is considered to be Jiva Mukta, which means basically liberated. And that's available for anybody who takes to the process of devotional service. Devotional service is so powerful that even a neophyte can be on the liberated platform just by following the instructions of the spiritual master. And so therefore, Hridayananda Maharaj quotes this verse, Tasmat Gurum Prapadyeta Jigyasu Sreya Uttama. Those who are inquisitive about their long-term benefit should approach a guru and learn the science of liberation, of purification, of yajna. Then they can convert their activities into transcendental activities. So the real purpose of this is the real the point of that of 434, tadvidhi pranipatena. One should approach, this is why we approach the spiritual master in a particular way. Pranipa, with respect. Pariprashnana, then inquire. In this verse is jigyasu, be inquisitive. Shreya uttamam, about the ultimate benefit for me, what is it? Then having receive instructions from a spiritual master, one should then sevaya, do some service. In other words, be active in devotional service. So the process is not that difficult. Now, as is mentioned here in the purport, one should give up selfish activities, perform for one's personal sense gratification. Since the result of such thoughtless work is further material bondage, but one should offer one's regular or occasional occupational duties to the Supreme Lord, and thus such activities become transcendental devotional service. So this is the trick, if you like, of spiritual life, is to work out what one's occupational duties are. Not that difficult, actually, because each one of us has natural propensities. We act in a particular way, and that becomes fairly obvious. You know, by the time we're teenagers, then, you know, our propensities start to manifest. So it's not difficult to work out what we're good at and what we're not good at. And whatever we happen to be good at, we can use that, as is mentioned here. Or our natural propensities. Occasional occupational duties can be offered to Krishna under the auspices of the spiritual master. Then one works on the platform of a liberated person. It's easy, actually. It's not difficult. Or put it this way, it's easy, but it's difficult. Because you know, in the beginning of the nectar, in the beginning of the 64 items of devotional service, I mentioned this before. In the beginning of the 64 items of devotional service, the first item is Ado Guru Pad Ashraya. The first item is to take shelter of the spiritual master. Now, and then the second item is to receive instructions from him.
Or her.
Someone who's learned in the science of devotional service, we can take instructions from. In fact, you know, we also we can, as Lord Chaitanya demonstrates, as Krishnadas Kaviraj demonstrates in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the beginning of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Vande Gurun, he offers his respectful obeisances to his spiritual masters. So we take instructions from many people, actually, on the path of devotional service. So, that's a simple process in one sense. We sit down, we hear instructions, we inquire for clarification, then we should just go and do. But it's interesting that Rupa Goswami then says that we then have to be prepared to accept things that ordinarily we might not. And we have to be prepared to give up things that we would ordinarily like to keep. So this is part of this is where the problems start. Right? When the spiritual master says, do this, and you think, oh, I don't feel like doing that. Well, no, I can't do that, that's too hard. So, you know, it's easy if you just do it and don't get on a mental platform, but it becomes very difficult when our attachments and our personal desires are challenged. This is the purification. Purification, the sublimation is, and the submission is key to success, in that we have to be prepared to sometimes put aside our personal desires and work purely for the pleasure of the spiritual master and the devotees, and ultimately for Krishna. That's where the maximum amount of purification comes from. Because as Vidyananda Maharaj mentions in the purport to that verse, Tasmat Guru Prapajeta, when we hang on to fruitive desires, in other words, what's in it for me, or if we hang on to, you know, the attachment to philosophical speculation, in other words, jnana and karma. If we hang on to those things, then he quotes Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura and says, then devotional service starts getting difficult. Right? Because then we want to do it my way, not the spiritual master's way. Or, you know, my way, but not Krishna's way. So this is when it gets, this is where we can run into problems. We become attached. Usually these attachments appear in the form of anartas. In other words, they're unnecessary or unwanted things, but we're closely attached to them, and we hang on to them, thinking that, you know, we'll die if we don't have them, or something will happen. Something will happen to us. We'll be unhappy if our attachments are taken away from us. So this learning of the science or the art of engaging everything in Krishna's service is the key to success in spiritual life. And that's why the relationship with the spiritual master, or shall we say the spiritual masters, those who teach us the process of devotional service, is so important. And to be honoured by the devotees. You know, we sing in the morning, you know, what is it? Guru Mukha Padma Bhakya Chitete Koriya Akya. Right? May my mind be purified by the words emanating from his lotus mouth. Right? So, you know, it's glorified, this process of receiving instructions from our spiritual teachers. They may even just be our friends. You know, we can take spiritual knowledge from, Prabhupada says you can even take spiritual knowledge if it's good instruction from a, you know, from somebody who's not qualified, even. In other words, if somebody gives you good advice, even if they're not qualified, you can still take that advice. Why speak of the devotees who are qualified and spiritually advanced and who can help and guide us? So, this whole process of receiving spiritual instruction and then following that instruction is glorified in the Vedas, glorified by the Acharyas, glorified by the devotees, because what happens is, even though it may be difficult on occasion, the realizations that come from purified work, from sacrifice, inspire the devotees to further make progress. You know, the realizations that one gets, and of course, you know, the greatest yajna for us is chanting Hare Krishna. This is the basic yajna, if you like. Right? Our basic yajna is a chant Hare Krishna. Mind you, chant Hare Krishna in a particular way. Without attachments. In other words, offenseless chanting of Hare Krishna. It is a great sacrifice. You know, you have to sit down for 2 hours, basically, and do nothing but hear the Maha Mantra. Sometimes that can be the most exquisite torture. You know, because the mind's doing this and that and the other thing, and going here and there and all over the place. I was sitting at home and I was on my last round. My father walked past me and he says, "You okay?" Because I was sort of on my last round, just trying to keep my mind focused on the mantra. I was wiggling around a lot. So, you know, again, you know, sacrifice, you have to sit in one place and you've got to just control the mind by hearing the mantra. And that can be like the most excruciating torture because the mind's all over the place. But when one's actually able to... when we're actually able to control the mind by engaging it in that sacrifice of hearing, then the purification that comes from that very simple activity and the inspiration, you know, that come from the insights that are revealed to us. Persistent, aren't they? Yeah, actually mine hasn't been turned off. Now you mention it. Oh no, it's off. I turned it off last night. Nothing worse than being woken up at midnight by somebody who wants to do. So a very simple activity, just chanting Hare Krishna, but the realizations that come, there's a real sacrifice. Then the inspiration comes to perform devotional service and to go further and further in sacrificing everything. Our attachments can easily be burned up, actually, just by this simple sacrifice. But we need to learn that process. And we learn that process by hearing from those more advanced, the spiritual teachers, the devotees. So in this way then, our ordinarily material activities are transformed. It's the same activity, practically speaking, the same activities. The devotees are not doing anything particularly different in terms of material action, doing the same things, going to work, earning money, putting money in the bank, cooking their meals, all these different things. But because the devotees are doing those things for Krishna's pleasure, then rather than material activities, they become fully spiritualized. And the potency of those spiritualized activities is that one becomes purified and disentangled from material affection. So the devotee can perform apparently the same activity as somebody else, but then be completely aloof from it. Detached. Not at all attached. And material desires become less. Become reduced. Whereas, you know, for the materialistic person performing the same activities, they become more attached. They want more and more and more. Become more absorbed in what they're doing on the material platform. And so they become entangled and caught up. This is a little test, actually. Test of chanting Hare Krishna and the test of our devotional service is when our material desires go down and we become more and more detached from things. And as a result, happy. Right? When you're not feeling attached and caught up in everything and just happy, you know, just doing your seva, if you like, then one can be quite blissful in that mood. But then when we're all attached and we've got to have it this way, we've got to do this or go out, life just becomes really a hassle. So it says here, one should give up selfish activities performed for one's personal sense gratification, since the result of such thoughtless work is further material bondage. But one should offer one's regular or occasional occupational duties to the Supreme Lord, thus such activities become transcendental devotional service. I think we'll finish here. Does anyone have any comments or questions on any of these points?
I think when the devotees come along, it's one stage when you can accept the Supreme Master, and also then be taken care of, but then rush into a relationship, into initiation or anything. And then you have also some of the people who just keep procrastinating, actually getting initiated. How would you deal with that, and how would you advise such people?
Well, Prabhupada wanted all of us to be spiritual masters. And when you think about it, as soon as somebody comes along and you start instructing them, then you become their spiritual master. If they're a new devotee, right? So, when we understand that we're actually training people and guiding them in their spiritual life right from the word go, then they already have shelter. Yeah? They've got the shelter of Prabhupada in the form of his representatives. They've got the shelter of Prabhupada in the form of his books. You know, the morning, the whole thing. So in one sense, you know, I see sometimes devotees are being get pressured or pushed. You've got to take shelter, you've got to take shelter, you've got to take shelter. But they already got shelter. They got Prabhupada, they got the rest of the devotees, they got the temple. So, you know, we don't actually have to push these things too much. And of course, a lot of us got to do with sincerity, you know. Prabhupada mentions that Krishna will reveal himself as the spiritual master, one who is sincere. So My experience is that devotees will automatically realize that they need to, you know, take a spiritual master and formalize that relationship, and that they need to take advantage of the instruction that they can get from the devotees. Right? Whether it's this devotee or that devotee or another devotee. In one sense, it doesn't matter. If we're acting as the transparent via medium, in other words, if we're giving Krishna consciousness as Krishna speaks it in the Bhagavad Gita, then people will benefit. Right? Because, you know, it does depend on the realization of the individual. Not everybody has the same realization and understanding. And some devotees are more advanced than others and are able to persuade, inspire, or explain the process of devotional service in a way that enthuses people. And it's important that one is enthused in one's devotional service. As is explained in this verse, Tasmat Gurum Tapancheta, the spiritual master should be able to remove the misgivings of the disciple. Right? By inspiring them. So we understand that there are levels of realization and levels of advancement. But, you know, the process is such, and the association of the devotees is such, that we really don't have to force people. It will happen, just naturally. You know, if you associate with the devotees, you chant Hare Krishna, you read Prabhupada's books, then, you know, what do we talk about most of the time? 50% of the time, what do we talk about? Huh?
Krishna.
Huh?
Krishna.
Yeah, where's the other 50%? How to serve. How to serve Krishna. We serve Krishna through his representatives. And those representatives are the spiritual teacher, the spiritual master. Right? But as I say, Prabhupada wanted us all to be spiritual teachers. He didn't reserve it for just a few people. He didn't say, "It's just a few of you that I want to be gurus." He didn't say that, ever. He said, you know, "My spiritual master told me to preach, and now I'm giving you the same instruction. All of you should go and preach and become spiritual masters." That's our responsibility, actually. Each one of us, that's our responsibility. According to our capacity. Right? Not that we all have to be big paramahamsas. Wherever we go, we're emitting, you know, rays of Vishnu. We don't have to do that. But in one sense, we are, you know, doing that when we just repeat Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavad Gita. So it's not like, you know, it's not like it's a... Well, here's the interesting thing. You know, Srila Prabhupada was not the only disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur who received the instructions to go and preach in the English language in foreign countries. It was an instruction that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur gave most of his disciples. You know what I mean? It wasn't a special instruction just for Prabhupada. It was just that he was the one who did it. Huh? So, that's my angle on it. People will work out in due course of time if they've got half a brain in their head and they've got their ears, you know, open. I'll work it out. That's what our preaching's for. So I don't know, you know, personally I don't think, from just my own realization, I don't worry about people, you know, surrendering or taking shelter or whatever. There's heaps of candidates doing that. Maybe that's because other people are worrying about it. Maybe I should worry about it, but I don't worry about it that much because I know that that's what they'll do. That our preaching, you know, that's just what happens. So if we let the process, you know, work, then people will come to that point. No, and they do. They come to me and they say, "Boo, I'm not sure who I should take shelter of. You know, I'd like to take a spiritual master." And I just say to them, "Well, you know, just keep chanting, and there's plenty of devotees, senior devotees that come here, and one of them may inspire you. Krishna will reveal these things in due course of time, like he did to the rest of us." Right? Not that we have to say, "Boo, time to take shelter." Right? As if they haven't already got shelter. They've already got shelter. Prabhupada's books, Prabhupada's instructions, other devotees' instructions, prasadam, a roof over their head. And, you know, in one sense, the shelter is the community of devotees that we can make advancement in, you know what I mean? And be comfortable and happy with friends in Krishna consciousness. That's probably one of the most important things. I remember when I joined the temple, Ajit Rup and I came from Adelaide to Melbourne, and we didn't have any friends here. And you sort of got this feeling, you know, sometimes that everybody's sort of like spying on you. And in fact, the devotees in one sense were, because they were thinking, "Well, she's no good and he's alright, so we'll separate them." That's what they were thinking. And I used to think, "Wow, when am I," and I didn't have any friends, and I was thinking, "When am I going to have a friend in Krishna consciousness?" Because, you know, friends are sort of important. Don't you reckon? Otherwise life would be pretty tough. And then, you know, after a year or so, I made some friends. And then I felt a lot more comfortable as a devotee. I just felt comfortable. So just the fact that we have an environment where we can have friends and we can talk to people and just, you know, share our realizations and our grizzles maybe, you know, or whatever. Not too many grizzles, hopefully. Then we've got shelter. We've got, you know, a place where we can practice. Because that's, ashram means a place of shelter, doesn't it? It means something else too. Shrama means useless. And ashrama means not useless. This is how Guru Govinda Maharaj explained it to me. So he said, "In our ashram we don't want any useless people." Ashrama means not useless. I thought that was a good explanation. But also, ashram is a place of shelter, so it's a place where we should be able to relax and share our challenges and whatever with our friends so that we can be inspired to go on. Then we've got shelter of Krishna consciousness. So in one sense, you know, that's what Krishna consciousness, the Society for Krishna Consciousness, is an environment where we can have our friends and we can do the things that we like to do together and being supported by each other, and then naturally we'll all make spiritual advancement. That's a good question there.
Prabhu?
Yeah?
I have a question.
Yeah?
You said that Prabhupada was the only one who spread the Prabhupada, like his Guru Maharaj instruction, and spread the Krishna consciousness everywhere. The thing is that we see disabling fluctuation, particular persons are mentioned, the Karanda Prabhu, like that.
Yes.
But there are so many disciples should be there. But why not they all have been mentioned and just particular...
why only the prominent ones?
Yeah.
well... It would be a very long list. It would be a very wide list of, if we mentioned everybody. So, the prominent ones are mentioned because those personalities evince the higher standard of, you know, devotional practice, devotional service. And so they're like the flag bearers, you know what I mean? They're the exemplars in devotional service. Because there are all others as well who are also worshipable and respectable. But in order to illustrate the potency of the parampara, then those special examples of devotional service are highlighted in order to you know, emphasize the process, emphasize the system, if you like, the parampara. But, you know, there are many devotees who have gone back home, back to Godhead, who are not listed in the parampara. Who are, you know, respectable devotees. But to highlight the, you know, the potency and the power of the process and these very special personalities are highlighted, mentioned, to inspire us and to help us understand, you know, what the process is also, what achievement, what advancement is, and what success is in Krishna consciousness. And it's interesting, actually, you know, somebody like Gaur-Kishore Das Babaji, who was a very exceptionally advanced devotee, but he was practically speaking illiterate. He couldn't even sign his own name. Just as an example. And yet Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur was a highly learned scholar. Well spoken, studied the Shastra, wrote books, and yet he took an initiation from, you know, somebody who was illiterate, effectively illiterate, because he understood the Shastra through his own realization, simply by hearing, right? He was deeply learned. So those, you know, those exemplary characters are highlighted to teach us the highest standards of devotional service. And in fact, you know, anybody who becomes Krishna conscious, pure devotee, actually has to adhere to the highest standards of devotional service. That's how you do it. So even those persons who were not mentioned but who were successful in devotional service, they did so by adhering to those high standards. Anything else? You can't sneak in through the back door. There's giant Vijay waiting for you.
What do you want?
What is the role of the Vikshuka and the Shikshuka?
The role?
I mean, you mentioned previously that taking Vikshuka was a formality. Or it's your formalized relationship.
Yeah. Siksha Guru is meant to train and instruct us. The Diksha Guru is the person who formalizes the relationship ceremoniously. Now, very often, as Prabhupada points out in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, The person that one takes Diksha from has already been the Siksha Guru for some time. And so that Diksha is just recognition of that relationship. Yeah. In ISKCON we have a slightly different system because, you know, sometimes devotees take initiation from somebody who doesn't really give them very much instruction. I know in my personal experience I was initiated by Bhavananda, but you know, Bhavananda gave me 3 or 4 or 5 instructions. But the people who really instructed me were Balaram and Korma, those two devotees especially. They were my main Siksha gurus. So I realised that after a while, I realised actually I should be offering these devotees a great deal of respect because they're training me to be a devotee. I'm living with them, you know, and I used to argue with them and fight with them sometimes. especially with Korma. But somehow or other I managed to maintain a modicum of respect. Because, you know, even in a very familiar situation, you know, and working very closely with somebody, you may not be always, you know, please accept my humble obeisances and dhammavats and all that stuff. But still I understood that these, and so I have, even to this day, I still have respect for those devotees because they were the people who effectively taught me to be a devotee. Personally taught me, you know, when I would sleep in the morning, Korma would come along and say, come on, get up, what are you doing?
I'm too tired, I can't get up. You're in my house. Get out of bed.
Right? So that's, you know, now that's real affection for somebody. I was thinking, what's he harassing me for? Go away, you bully. Right? But actually he was showing affection for me by bothering to turn me over in my sleeping bag and get me out of bed. Go and chart the rounds. At the time I was thinking, this guy's just bullying me. But actually he wasn't. He was encouraging me to improve my devotional service. So, you know, we want to be on this relationship with our guru where he's always smiling at us and we're always doing what he tells us to do and stuff. But it's not always like that in reality. You know, reality can be a lot more, it can be a harsher thing. But I realise I owe my spiritual life to these devotees. So I should be respectful to them. At least, you know, on the right occasions, in the official occasions I should be respectful. And most of the other times too. But there, you know, sometimes there can be a situation where you can, this is why, you know, you can inquire from somebody. So we inquire submissively or in the right manner. So, we do need to recognise and acknowledge those devotees who are actually guiding us and who have a role in our day-to-day, you know, practice of Krishna consciousness. Because it is a very familiar relationship, sometimes it may not manifest, you know, in this, formal guru-disciple relationship. May not manifest fully in that. But it is, the relationship is still there. And you know, can still appreciate and value that, even if it may not be in that fully sort of awe and reverential relationship, where the disciple always does what the guru tells him to do. But even then, actually, even in that relationship, we see it in ISKCON. The devotees have this very warm, reverential relationship with their guru, yes, Guru Maharaj. The guru tells them to do things, and they say, yes, Guru Maharaj. And then what do? They just go off and do what they want to do. I remember one time, I wasn't there, but Bhagavananda went to Adelaide, and the devotees were sleeping in, and they weren't going to the program. And, but when he was there, all jumping up and down, joy, 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 offering their flowers and catching the cookies. We used to have a cookie toss in the kirtans. Actually, it was quite dangerous. And the gurus used to throw the cookies into the crowd, and the brahmacharis go, either their mudajis or kids there, you know. But Bhavananda said to the devotees, he said, look, I don't want your flowers. What's the good of your flowers? And you're jumping up and down. He said, oh, I'm not impressed by that. What I want you to do is get up and go to Mongolia and chant 16 rounds. You know, do the basic things. Yeah.
More often, we are actually very much respected and attached to our Guru Maharaj.
Yeah.
But we tend to ignore the other Guru Maharaj and
or the other devotees.
Type of thing.
Yes, that's called neophyte. It's called Kanishta Adhikari. Madhyam Adhikari makes friends with all the devotees and can recognize that Krishna's present. All of the Prabhus, they're all my masters. Huh?
And then we get angry, we tend to.
Get what?
Sometimes we get angry.
Angry.
But we don't show the anger.
Ah, good.
This type of things does happen. You know, we feel burned within the heart and this type of things. So what should be done for that?
I have to make some advancement, I guess. I have to learn to see things with a little broader perspective in life. We need to learn that we can... A lot of it comes about as a result of this overemphasis on the Diksha Guru and not enough understanding of the fact that we have more than one. And that's what I always say. Krishna Das Kaviraj says, Vande Gurun Isha Bhaktam Isha Bhattarakam. He offers his, first of all, he offers his obeisances to his spiritual masters. One of them was his initiating guru, but the others were all his instructing gurus. Lord Nityananda was one of those. Raghunath, Rupa, Raghunatha Pade, Raghunath Das, and Rupa Goswami, you know, these were his gurus. Lord Nityananda was his, I think it was Lord Nityananda the initiating spiritual master of Krishna Das Kaviraj? Yeah. So, you know, we can get this idea in our head. I only have one guru and I should only take instructions from that person. There's nobody else who can tell me what to do. Because they're not qualified. Huh? That's not how Prabhupada set up ISKCON. Prabhupada set up ISKCON in such a way so that actually what he wanted was that the temple authorities, the temple president, other senior devotees would be advanced enough. Actually, he wanted all of us to be advanced enough so that we could instruct young, you know, aspiring devotees, aspiring candidates. Huh? And in those days, Prabhupada was the only guru. Right? But you imagine what kind of a chaos it would be, you know, if everybody said, I can only take instructions from Prabhupada. I'm not going to take instructions from anybody else. And in fact, Prabhupada does say, he mentions, you know, if you can't live with the other devotees in this ISKCON, then you can come and live with me. He does say that in Chaitanya Charitamrita, but that's not what he wanted. And he was, you know, referring to particular prickly cases, particular prickly personalities. But actually Prabhupada wanted the GVC and the temple presidents and, you know, the leaders to look after, to give this, and he would say that. He said that to the GVC. He also said it to the, in letters to temple presidents, you are the Siksha gurus. I am the initiating guru. And he would say to the devotees, you go to this one, go to that one. Take instructions from them. They're reading my books. They're following my instructions. Follow their instructions, and you're following my instructions. Because how Prabhupada set it up. So Prabhupada set up this God. So broad, not just, yeah, my guru, nobody else. That's actually Kanishtha mentality.
So the emphasis that Srila Prabhupada did give to many Siksha gurus, why do we have the ritviks who emphasize Prabhupada as the only guru?
Oh God, why? That is a very good question. Why? Oh, well, it really is a response to the failing, the fall downs of the original 11 or so gurus. Not all of them, but those who did have difficulties, spiritual difficulties. And so what they said was, look, there's nobody qualified after Prabhupada. Huh? So therefore we have to take shelter of Prabhupada. Because he's the only person qualified. That's one explanation. What do you think?
Most importantly, they don't want to be authority more than anything else. They want to be the authority.
Yeah, they want to be the guru. But because the ISKCON leaders won't let them be gurus, so therefore they say Prabhupada's the only guru. But then they end up being the ones who initiate on behalf of Prabhupada. So effectively they become the gurus. In reality, that's what happens. It's ISKCON history. 80s. So it's a reaction to the as I was discussing this, I met a very nice devotee in Varshana at the Japa retreat, who's same age as myself, and we had similar experiences. He was from Sweden, a friend of Jirunji's. Devotee joined pretty much the same time as Jirunji. We were just discussing this, you know, Prabhupada didn't see, but what happened was the devotees that Prabhupada originally set up as interim gurus, right, to initiate on his behalf while he was still present and hadn't departed, they then, the GBC appointed them more or less as the official gurus for ISKCON. And for some time, they were the only people who were allowed to be gurus. There were other god brothers who wanted to be gurus or felt they had that responsibility as Prabhupada had given it to them, but they were restricted. And in fact, there was a board, you know, there was even an Acharya board created in the GBC itself of those devotees who were the gurus. And from memory, I think they were also the only ones, they said, well, we're the only ones who are allowed to choose new gurus. Right? Now, that was actually quite an offensive thing to do, because Prabhupada never ever intended that. And didn't say, you're the only gurus. And this point was brought to the attention of the GBC by a number of senior devotees, but it was ignored. And as a result of that offence, basically, at the lotus feet of their god brothers, basically, then a number of those devotees had serious spiritual difficulties. So it was, you know, it was a tragedy, actually, because it was misunderstanding of how Prabhupada wanted to implement the initiating system. And in one sense, there's been a problem. You know, it's still to a lesser degree a problem even today, because these things are not clearly understood. But that's how that, and that's why the Ritviks sort of came about, because of this confusion and these offences that were committed. Then devotees fell down. Then the Ritvik philosophy came about that, you know, well, actually nobody's qualified, so therefore, you know, the only guru can be Prabhupada, because that's not what Prabhupada said at all. So, you know, out of confusion came more confusion, in one sense. How's that sound?
That's just a tag on to that question. I'm just saying, maybe as a reaction to Gurus falling down in this time, there's another undercurrent which emphasizes taking initiation from other Gurus, for instance, in the Gaudiya Mutt.
Yeah. Well, we don't do that because Prabhupada told us not to, very clearly. You know, there are many statements where Prabhupada said, you know, they cannot help us, but they can hinder us. You know what I mean? More than one statement where Prabhupada did not want his disciples to take siksha outside of ISKCON. Because, I tell you, one of the main reasons for that is because Prabhupada's godbrothers, there were many who respected him, but even amongst those who respected him, they would, one way or another, minimise some of the things that Prabhupada did. And Prabhupada knew that was not at all healthy for his disciples. You know. So, yeah, you know, there are those who say we should take initiation from Prabhupada, there are those who say we should take children from some other person. My experience is better to stay in ISKCON, despite its faults and all the impure devotees that exist in ISKCON. Stick with it. Because, you know, for a start, they're not impure, they're on the path of perfection, and it is a big family. Somehow or other, Prabhupada was empowered by Krishna to create a society of devotees that effectively can make spiritual advancement. That's how, you know, I've been reading this book called the Yoga of Kirtan, is it? The Kirtan? Yoga of Kirtan? Yeah. And I was reading Jamuna's interview, and it really touched me. And, you know, sometimes you read a book and it can really affect you emotionally. I was almost crying just reading her reminiscence of her meeting Prabhupada, and it just reminded me of when I met the devotees and what an impact it had on my life. You know, it was just you know, the course of my life changed out of just darkness and confusion to hope and light, you know. And I was thinking, you know, I didn't meet Prabhupada, but effectively I did by meeting his disciples, by meeting, you know, by meeting Radha Vallabha and the devotees and the whole process of Krishna consciousness. It had the same effect on me. So, you know, Prabhupada was the person who did that. It wasn't anybody else. It wasn't someone else that made the sacrifice, that put in the effort, the endeavour, made the devotees, and then had those devotees then go out and preach and make us into devotees. That was Prabhupada. It wasn't anybody else. So That's why we owe it to Prabhupada to, you know, further perpetuate what he gave us. This is my understanding of things. And why we shouldn't go outside of ISKCON. He didn't want us to do that. And he gave us, you know, to say that Prabhupada, you know, nobody's qualified after Prabhupada is diminishing him, actually. Diminishes Prabhupada. And also, not only does it diminish Prabhupada, but it also flies in the face of all of our experience, because each one of us is making advancement in Krishna consciousness. We're becoming purified. Or, you know, when we're not following properly, then we become monks again. So that also proves that it works. When we don't do it properly, then we become idiots. Inverse reasoning, right? Look, it works because you're not doing it properly and now you're behaving like an idiot. Follow properly and what happens? You become a pure devotee. Powerful. It's so powerful. So, yeah, there are a lot of philosophies and there is, you know, a fairly distinct path of Krishna consciousness that we have to clearly adhere to. And, you know, in my understanding, Ritvik is not very practical. And, you know, going outside is, you know, you can do it, but you lose so much if you do. Yes, Bhakti.
There's also this misunderstanding that when you talk about this, that, you know, when you have a first form, you want to see a spiritual community as perfect. You want to see everything
perfect.
You think that everything should be perfect. But what you don't realize is that the perfection includes the imperfections.
Well, that's the story that Prabhupada told about the thief who went on a pilgrimage. And, you know, he got overcome by his thieving tendencies and he tried to steal everybody's belongings, but then he realized, hang on a second, this is not a good idea. So then he tried to put everything back, but created disturbance in the process. So, yeah. Api chet sudaracharo bhajate mammananyabak sadureva samantavya samyak hi vyavaso was it vyavaso hi sahaja. So yeah, devotees may have imperfections, but because they're on the path of perfection, gradually those imperfections will be purified. And see, here's the thing, you see. The other example that I like to give is, you know, gems usually come and they come rough cut, right? So they've got all sorts of rough edges on them. And the process for turning them into smooth, polished gems is you get all the rough cut stones and you throw them into a machine basically looks like a concrete mixer. And they pour water in, and then they press the button, and then it just rolls around and around and around. And they all bang into each other. And gradually, by the banging into each other over a period of time, all the rough edges get knocked off of each other, and they become smooth. So, you know, we're all rough-cut devotees, and we're put into the ISKCON washing machine, polishing machine, if you like. And then we turn around and around and around inside. And that way we become purified. And in that way, actually, we value the devotees' association. You know, my old Sankirtan buddies, you know, we used to fight over which side of the street you're going to do.
I'm going to do this side. No, you're not doing this side, I'm doing that side.
So we would, you know, we'd do all sorts of stupid things. But now we, you know, we're all over 50 and we can laugh about what we did when we were 23. Some of the stupid things we did. I went, Push Bunsley and I went to Tasmania and we refused to put 10 cents in the hot water in a dispenser, so we had cold showers. Then he came back and spent 3 weeks in bed with pneumonia. He got so sick. So anyway, you know, there's different things that you do when you're young that are quite silly, but over time, you know, you become purified and you mature, hopefully, and make some spiritual advancement in the process. Together. Huh? All right, I think we should go. Gajra Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaura Bhaktavrinda ki jai.